Museums are a world of their own. They provide public-facing elements, exhibits, galleries, educational features, and events. But behind the scenes are people constantly at work in unseen, perhaps mysterious roles. This is Erin Jones, director of the Museum and Gallery at Bob Jones University, with M&G's podcast called Art Break. This month's focus is a conversation with a conservator. Bill Brown is recently retired from the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh, North Carolina, and he has worked on numerous projects through the years as head conservator at the museum. But he's now shifted to private practice, which is what has brought him to M&G. He's preparing some of our old masters to go out on exhibit.
Hi, my name is Bill Brown. I'm the former chief conservator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. In 1988, I went to the North Carolina Museum of Art for my internship to complete a master's degree in conservation and stayed for 32 years. And I'm very happy to be retired and pursuing other opportunities, like here at Bob Jones University.
All right, so Bill, why don't you explain what a conservator is and does?
A conservator is a combination of preservation and restoration. In other words, we are responsible for caring for the art, but we also have the responsibility of restoring the art as close as we can to the intention of the artist. So my experience is working at the North Carolina Museum of Art as a museum conservator, and museum conservators are, our primary responsibility is the care of the collection, although, you know, we do the conservation work in the lab. You know, part of it involves researching the artifacts, but also restoring the artifacts, which can be quite satisfying. But not to be understated is the importance of caring for the collection, which is to make sure that the collection lasts for another generation, for, you know, other generations to appreciate. And there's a whole range of duties that we're responsible for, from dusting to making sure that the paintings travel safely and so forth.
So how would you detect or know that a work needs to be restored?
Well, let me just say that art museums are different from private practice. So I'm now in private practice. In an art museum, the assumption pretty much is that the entire collection is in good condition. There have been generations of conservators and collections care, and the collections, frankly, don't change very much. But at the art museum, I'd say about once every month, we would go out and dust the entire collection. We also would, every week on Monday when the museum's closed, we'd go out and look at the collection and just, you know, walking around, making sure primarily that something is not awry. Like, for example, is there a broken pipe? Is there, you know, water leaking down the wall? There's some obvious things that, you know, can cause damage to the collection. But we also check for the presence of insects, and we make sure that the light levels are not too high so that the pigments don't fade. There's a full range of, mostly it's the environment in which the art is displayed and also stored in. You know, so we are constantly checking those conditions to make sure temperature, humidity, light levels, insects are under control, and we have various programs and policies that are also set up to follow, to ensure the safety of the art.
So then when there is a work of art that does need to have some conservation, how would you even clean a painting or go about conserving it and improving it or trying to bring it back to its more normal condition?
Well, every painting is different. So every painting has its own story. You know, so when we look at a painting to treat, maybe there's an obvious problem, like maybe the varnish is yellow or discolored. In traditional collections like the Bob Jones collection and the Old Master collection in North Carolina, the artists, the old masters, would use natural resin varnishes. And restorers also use natural resin varnishes. Some still use them today. And these varnishes will oxidize and change and become yellow, discolored, and harder to remove. In other words, a varnish that was originally soluble in like mineral spirits might require acetone, which is a more aggressive solvent. So we first have to, if it's a varnish removal, we have to assess the condition of the varnish, and we can look at it under ultraviolet illumination. And we can also, there are analytic techniques we can use to identify what kind of varnish it is and what its properties are. And that's where chemistry comes in quite a bit. Every program-trained conservator has a chemistry background, and that background is there to help the conservator understand the materials that the artist uses, but also the to make sure that they're using materials for the restoration that won't yellow. So a natural resin varnish will yellow, say, after a generation, whereas the varnishes we use will not. They'll stay clear and unyellowed. It's very different in the private practice world, because if you're a freelance conservator, people are basically taking to you a damaged painting. So maybe a painting was damaged in a move. Maybe the mover dropped the painting on a chair and there's a, you know, big rip, you know, in the canvas. I mean, that doesn't happen very often in art museums, although...
Thankfully,
there have been situations. I've seen a painting fall off the wall and the frame break, and I've seen a New World object fall off a cart and break into like Humpty Dumpty into many pieces. Mm-hmm. So, you know, accidents do happen. We're humans. We're not infallible, even though in an art museum, everybody is specifically trained to care for the collection and display it safely. But if you're in freelance, people are going to drive up and they're going to, you know, carry this painting in that, you know, has a horrible tear in it, or, you know, and then you're also going to get the story behind the painting. My great-grandmother painted this. It's been in the attic, and you look at it and it's full of, you know, flies have been dropping excrement on it, or, you know, it has tears and rips and dust. And I think usually with freelance, it's pretty obvious that you have a problem and you're more in the category of fixing it, whereas really in a museum, it's more about prevention. Although I think all conservators, whether they're in private practice or in a museum, part of our mission is to make sure that we educate the public as to how to properly care for their art and their collection. And I think people are generally appreciative of that.
So when you are in the process of doing restoration, or maybe it is removing that resin layer that you're talking about, can you maybe describe a little bit about how you do that? Because again, I'm not sure that very many people do understand maybe the time-consuming nature of that, or the carefulness that you are following in order to accomplish that.
Well, to begin with, if you are not a trained conservator, you should not be cleaning your own painting. You might get lucky and not do any damage. More than likely, you will do damage, and you may or may not know it until you take it to a conservator, and they're going to lecture you about how only a trained conservator should clean a painting. Because, like I said before, every painting has its own story. Every painting has specific materials and that the artist used, and particularly all master collections have been restored over and over again. When a painting is bought and sold, maybe between wars, paintings move around. I know the Bob Jones collection, the NCMA collection, a lot of the old masters came into our possession after the Second World War. And then people donate paintings and so forth. Anyhow, the most important thing is for the conservator to first examine the painting, and we take photographs, we do documentation that's required by our code of ethics and standards of practice. So we are as familiar with the materials the artist used as we possibly can. Then you put your toe into the water, and the first thing that you do is to take a small piece of cotton wrapped on I use a bamboo skewer. Basically, I'm creating a Q-tip. very small slender Q-tip, and then I dip it into a solvent, and I already have a pretty good idea of what the varnish is that I'm removing. I may know that I could put it into acetone and it would come right off, but conservators are very measured and careful in their approach. So I have a whole range of cleaning solvents that I use from weakest to strongest. And so I'll start with the weakest, which might be mineral spirits or even saliva, and then gradually work up to, say, acetone, and then see if the varnish actually comes off. And usually what you end up doing is, like for a oxidized natural resin coating like Damar or Mastic, usually it's either alcohol or acetone removes it, but then you want to cut that solvent with a weaker solvent so that you find a mix that is just strong enough to remove it. Because obviously what you're trying to do is not damage the paint layer underneath. So you have to find a solvent that removes the varnish but doesn't damage the paint layer. And that's where the chemistry comes in and the understanding of the technology, the materials that the artist used.
So what do you enjoy most as a conservator?
For me, I think most conservators, well, I should really just speak for myself, but most conservators, I guess you could say we use both sides of our brain. So we like science and we like art, and conservation really combines the two. And so there's all of this investigation, analysis, which I like a lot. It's like you're trying to solve a mystery. You're trying to understand what's in front of you. But there's also the appreciation of what's in front of you. And that's so important. And that's kind of the art side. So which kind of leads me to, really what I enjoy the most is just sitting in front of a great piece of art. And it may take me a year, 6 months, or a year to actually restore it, and I'm never bored in front of it. It's like the longer, I'm working with the painting, the more I appreciate it. And I feel like when I finish the project, I'm like the world's expert on that painting. And then I move to another one.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, since you're here this week working on some paintings or preparing them for a loan, why don't you describe a few of the projects that you've worked on for the museum and gallery previously?
Well, most recently, I was involved in vetting a large number of paintings that went to an exhibition that Aaron curated for the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. And so this may sound boring, but again, it's, any opportunity to engage with the art. But Bob Jones has such a great collection and it's so diverse. So it involved me coming down here for about a week and just going through the paintings and making sure that, first showing the technicians here how to install a backing board. That's the preventative care that's so necessary. Spending time with watercolors to touch in losses in frames. There was one actually rather complicated issue with the bottom corner of a painting where there had been an impact in the bottom right corner and the stretcher was split. The canvas had come off of the stretcher and it actually had to laminate it. The painting had been lined. I won't go into the lining procedure, but it was a really complicated little problem and it was located in this corner. So, typically when you treat a painting, you treat the whole painting, you would remove the lining, you would put a new stretcher on, but, the urgency was to get these prepared for this exhibition. And this was, an important painting for the exhibition. So, I had to come up with devise a way to treat it here, and I had all of my supplies here. And, remove the canvas from that corner and flatten it and reattach it. And, so it was a tricky little problem, but I think the results were very good. And then the painting, to see the painting on view and the canvas nice and flat and that, distortion gone is very satisfying.
That's right. And you had a lot of paintings, 64 to look at for that whole
week. That's a lot of paintings.
You covered a lot of ground. So what are some of the oldest objects you've worked on?
Well, one of the oldest is one of the first I worked on when I came to the art museum in Raleigh as an intern. And it's this Egyptian jackal. So it's a sculpture of a jackal, you know, very stylized in an Egyptian style, thousands of years old. And originally it was gilded, you know, so it was completely gold, which is amazing because after thousands of years, I mean, most of it was still intact, but there were areas where the gesso was popping off from the wood. You know, it had been carved in wood and then coated with this white priming material and then gilded with sheets of, you know, very thin gold. And there were other areas where the gold was abraded. So what was most amazing to me, I think, was that the gesso, when it was originally prepared, was basically a white pigment ground into a glue, probably some sort of animal skin glue. That material was still sensitive to moisture, you know, thousands of years later. So when I treated it, you know, I basically treated it like I would treat a Renaissance painting, you know, where you would introduce some moisture, you know, into the cracks and it would soften the gesso and then you could set it down with a tacking iron. So it was still responsive. I mean, that's what was so incredible to me. And then the areas where the gold was missing, some areas we restored, some we didn't, but those decisions were made, the restoration decisions were made with the curator. Mm. And again, another advantage, I guess, of working in an art museum is that you're working with curators. So these conversations about, you know, should I leave that loss in the gilding the way it is, you know, maybe, you know, it was created, you know, thousands of years ago, or should I repair it and restore it? So I think mostly we restored it, and it's on view now. I'm in the collection.
Wow, and they let you do that as an intern?
As an intern, well, and part of it, too, was we, at the Art Museum, at the time, we only had paintings conservators, and when I went to graduate school in conservation, I worked on quite a few objects, so I also had some ability, I think, working on objects, which I still like these kind of objects. I like the wooden objects that have paint on them, either gilded or polychrome. Like there's that beautiful, is it a virgin, I think?
It is.
At the Museum of the Bible.
It's a virgin and child, yes, that's right.
Which is a polychrome carved, carved sculpture that's then painted. And because the wood expands and contracts, the paint was popping off all over, and there are lots of little losses. Each one is a blemish. And when you touch it all in, then you can see the object again as a three-dimensional whole.
Do conservators normally specialize, though? Because you're saying that you can blend. You can do some objects and art, though. So what's normal?
Well, specialization is normal. Art museums, well, like with Bob Jones' collection. I mean, the original collection was really all about putting it into context. You know, so the original gallery was set up with all these beautiful, you know, furniture and wood walls and ceilings and stained glass. And, you know, so if you're a caretaker or a conservator for that collection, you really have to stretch your abilities. And it's actually the same at the art museum. We just hired our first objects conservator 2 years ago. Before then, you know, there were three of us and we were paintings conservators. And I also had quite a bit of experience in paper and, you know, I was the one who did all the matting and hinging. So we would sort of, you know, split some of that up. But if there's, you know, something like an object that required, you know, was a complex project or very valuable, we would contract it out. So we'd have to bring somebody in, a specialist in objects conservation, to come in and work on it. But I've always liked working on objects. Well, then there's all this sort of back and forth between paintings conservators and objects conservators. You know, they say that we only care about the surface, and which is generally true. But in my case, it's not. I love the polychrome work particularly.
So you shared then an ancient object. Have you worked on any modern works of art or objects?
Actually, the last object I worked on at the Art Museum was a modern-day gouache, which is like pastel, but it's like an opaque. I mean, it's like watercolor, but it's an opaque watercolor. So there's a white pigment that's added in with all the colors. Anyhow, for reasons we don't completely understand, big chunks of the gouache had popped off. So this is a, Portrait of a Woman by David Park, and it was, I think, from the 1950s or 60s. You know, sort of an abstracted, figurative composition. And then it had these big losses, you know, which completely ruined the painting. So the challenge was, for me, was to, well, first to consolidate or set down the cleavage so it wouldn't get worse, and that required introducing, you know, a specific adhesive that we had, you know, worked out, just like with coming up with a solvent to remove varnish. If you're going to have to glue back down, you know, a flaking paint, you also have to be very careful about what adhesive you used. And actually, it's interesting because it's sort of the same problems with the Jackal as what I had with the David Park, where when you're introducing the adhesive, you know, with a brush, and the adhesive is in a liquid state, and you're introducing it, you know, to the little piece of paint or gouache or gesso that is popping up, you have to be really careful because it's absorbed by the gesso, and then you can get little tide lines that form. So, you know, you can actually, you know, set down the cleavage, but then you have a little dark ring, you know, around the paint loss, and that's really hard to get rid of. And that's a real problem with both pastel and gouache and, you know, these old Egyptian pieces, which is kind of interesting. So we used a particular adhesive that worked really well, where you can introduce it without staining the material. I won't go into that. And then I still had these losses to fill. And so I used, again, I couldn't use something liquid because it would stain the gouache. So I took this beautiful set of soft pastels that we have and took a little swab and would just rub a little bit of the soft pastel on the swab and then dab it into the loss. And yeah, it was really challenging to get it in all the way up to the edge and not to go over. Once all of the losses were filled, they just disappeared completely. And, you know, the pieces appreciated, and actually the donor of this particular piece and many of the other contemporary pieces was really kind of embarrassed about the condition of this painting. So it was really satisfying for him to see it fixed, and he was very, you know, appreciative. So, yes. So that means something too.
Yes, it does. So with old masters, once you do some restoration, you would also finish it with a kind of a varnish to protect it. Is there any sort of layer like that that you would be able to put on the gouache? Anything like that would just help it maintain and sustain?
The best thing you can do with a gouache is to not varnish it. I mean, there are what's called fixatives that you can spray on. So if you go to an art supply store, you know, there are pastel fixatives. And, you know, they sort of fix all of these, you know, soft particles of pigment. They fix them in place. But they also tend to darken the surface. And then once you've applied it, you can't remove it. And one of our underlying principles in conservation is that whatever we apply to the object, we should be able to remove it without doing further damage. So the best solution for a pastel is to display it behind glazing, behind glass or plexiglass, so it's always protected.
Well, what are some of the current projects you're doing?
Well, of course, I'm working with Bob Jones University and Aaron. Actually, there's a painting that, one of my first paintings in private practice. I've been doing work for a couple of clients for years, and there's one client who has a collection of paintings from, they were all painted as part of the Black Mountain School, which was a group of artists who had a community in Black Mountain in North Carolina, Western North Carolina, and they taught classes and they painted some really, you know, amazing art. And Joseph Albers is probably the most famous artist who was a part of this group. But this painting was by an artist named Ilya Bulatowski. And his paintings look a lot like the paintings of Mondrian, where they're very geometric and, you know, simple colors and shapes, but there's always a subtle sort of play of, you know, push-pull and different planes. You know, he's very much interested in the philosophy of math and all of that. But anyhow, this particular painting had never been varnished, and it was covered with grime and soot, and had completely lost its pizzazz. You know, the colors were no longer bright. But when I started doing the careful cleaning test, you know, it was pretty clear that the colors were very sensitive to just about anything from water, saliva, solvents. And it depended on the color. Like the white was a little more robust. The red was just incredibly sensitive. So I had to come up with a sort of gradated system of cleaning each color. So for the white, we have this. It's actually called a citric acid solution, which is sort of a imitation of saliva. But instead of saliva, which of course is gross and variable, you know, this is a very specific, you know, combination of substances, and it works really well on removing grime, cigarette smoke, that kind of thing. It worked right on the whites, but not on the reds. So for the reds, I actually had to use a dry cleaning technique using eraser crumbs. And because the shapes are very geometric and the edges are very clean, like from red to white, you know, I had to shape the eraser, you know, so that I can get right up to the edge and sort of work it with my fingers. And so that's kind of using my sort of paper conservation skills mm-hmm. and applying it towards art. Mm-hmm. And for contemporary art, it's very different than Old Master. I think with Old Master paintings, you're also dealing with, you know, the object itself and the context in which it was created in a church or a chapel, and it may be on a chunk of wood or, you know, polychrome. Contemporary art can be just as complicated, all kinds of different materials, and the artists are expressing themselves, not necessarily creating works of art that last. So, you know, 50 years later, they come to me and, you know, and that this painting, I mean, when it was cleaned, it was beautiful because the colors were brilliant and you could see the subtle changes and how the composition worked. And so, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's an advantage to working in an art museum as opposed to freelance. I mean, I have no idea what's going to, you know, come through my door. So I think in a way it's going to require a lot of adaptation and, you know, cleverness. And
how long did it take for you to clean that work?
It took about a week of 8-hour days.
Wow. Eraser crumbs.
Eraser crumbs, yes. But these are special erasers.
Okay. All right. Well, what's the most valuable object you've worked on? And did you get nervous while you're working on it?
Let's see. I've worked on two that are really valuable, a Monet Etretat, but also the Giotto altarpiece that's in our collection. It's the only complete Giotto altarpiece in North America, so it's very important. Mm-hmm. He's like the father of the Renaissance, and modern art starts with him, all of that. But it was an opportunity to actually go to the Getty. So actually, they had requested the painting, the altarpiece, for an exhibition that examined the crossover between panel painting and illuminated manuscript painting. So we had artists who were doing both. But the painting had some condition issues. So I traveled with the painting to the Getty and working with their chief conservator, who is an expert on early Italian painting, we came up with a process, and, you know, we worked together. And so on the one hand, I mean, this painting it's priceless. It's worth a lot of money. But, you know, I had the confidence of being at the Getty and working with someone else. But still, I mean, you know, sometimes you're using a little scalpel, maybe you're removing, you know, something that doesn't belong, and, you know, you could slip, you know, a big chunk could fall off. And it's not enough that you know that you can fix it. I mean, it's horrifying to think that, you know, this chunk of paint has been on there since, you know, the 1300s, and now it's not. So we do try to endeavor to save every bit of paint, you know, so it's all important. So, I mean, I think that's the biggest problem is that, you know, you could be working, everything is going fine, and then all of a sudden there's an explosion, I mean, a micro explosion, and you lose a flake of paint and it crumbles and it's lost forever.
That's right. All right. Well, do you have any favorite, or maybe that even fits in the most memorable project category? What were they and why? Why would it be your favorite or memorable?
Well, this would be in the category of most challenging, but favorite too in the results. The museum has two beautiful landscapes by Bernardo Bellotto, Venetian painter, painted in the 18th century. And his uncle is Canaletto, who painted scenes of Venice. Bellotto was painting scenes of Dresden. And so our two were scenes of Dresden. And so for an exhibition that was being curated at the Houston Museum, we agreed to send the paintings and we agreed to treat them because the varnish was really discolored. Anyhow, there were two of them. I treated one. My colleague treated the other. But as I'm cleaning it, I mean, the cleaning doesn't start until you have fully documented the painting. You've looked at it. You've identified the restoration. So I'm cleaning it, and then I realize that there's a figure missing.
After you've cleaned it, there's a figure missing.
So there was a. So what I realized was that before I cleaned it, there was a figure missing. Because I'm cleaning this area in the foreground of the painting, and there's a boy who's just caught a lamprey and probably his uncle or father, and, you know, it's a domestic scene. And so he's holding the lamprey up to him, or he's holding a lamprey up, but the father is missing. Mm. And the only way that I could tell that there was a figure there is all that was left of him when I cleaned the painting was the corner of a brim of a hat. But we knew that these paintings were copies of an original set that was on view in Dresden. So I looked at the original, and then I could see that, oh, actually there was a figure there, and it was like the father, you know, was at the top of, you know, there's a lake, and the kid has just caught a fish, and he's showing it to his dad, and there's this whole, you know, scene going on. And the whole bottom of the painting had lost a lot of paint, probably had been removed from the canvas and rolled up and when it was shipped to England. And so anyhow, when a restorer repainted it or fixed it, they didn't paint the figure back in. I mean, they may not even known that there was a figure there. So anyhow, that was very satisfying to actually restore a complete figure. But, you know, a conservator wouldn't typically do that. You would, you know, leave it unrestored and you document it. Maybe the label would say something about it. But because this was an exact copy of the original version in Dresden, we knew what the figure looked like, even though there were differences. And then I realized there was another figure, too, that was missing, like her whole bottom half. And it's hard sometimes to know the extent of the damage because the restorers can use tricks, like they use these masking varnishes. So if this painting was being sold maybe to a rich American client, then to conceal the true condition, they would put this masking varnish on, which would make it impossible to look at it under a UV light and see the damage. You know, so me thoroughly looked at the painting. The world's expert on Bellotto used to work at the museum, Peter Bowron. He never noticed that it was missing, and it wasn't until I actually started to clean it that. So it's a lot of shock involved. And it's worked the other way around, too, where a whole figure has come off, and then you realize that it was restored. But now you have a painting that's missing a figure. And so old master paintings, this is sort of not common, but it's not unusual. Because they've been through cycles of restoration. They've been damaged, moved around. And so that's part of the challenge of old master paintings.
So the father figure in there is by Bill Brown?
Were the father is by Bill Brown. Or? I should have maybe signed it on the brim of his hat. Or
maybe.
So I'll show it to you someday.
I would like to see Bill Brown's father figure. So as you restored works of art, are there any other unusual or noteworthy things? It could be in the other research or, again, on the work itself as you were cleaning. I mean, you've shared that the colors come back and how brilliant they can be. I just didn't know if there are any other types of stories, discoveries.
I mean, usually in the examination of a painting, we'll find surprises. Like, for example, if you are x-raying a painting, you may find that there are figures that the artist painted out. And we have a couple of those in our old master collection. Actually, there's one by a 17th century Dutch painter. And if you x-ray the painting, you see that there's a still life underneath. What you see with the naked eye is a portrait. Mm-hmm. And then when you x-ray it, what you see is that underneath the portrait, there's a still life. So he had first painted a still life and then for whatever reason decided to paint over it. So he turned it from horizontal to vertical and then did the portrait of a man. So, I mean, you know, they're recycling. I mean, you know, they're in business and they're not, you know, going to throw away anything that can be recycled. And so, and sometimes you'll see, you know, where figures have been edited out, which is sort of the process of painting, you know, where they may be, there was a figure back here and now he's not there. Or the Botticelli. We have a Botticelli tondo and it's the Holy Family. And Botticelli was fooling around with adjusting the figure of Joseph off to the side. You can see where he was adjusting. He was holding a staff and he was adjusting it various ways. And you could see that in the infrared reflectogram. And then you could compare that to early drawings that he had done, you know. So, and that's, for that Botticelli, that's evidence that this is an original painting, that he's actually working out the composition and then maybe he takes that original composition and copies it, you know, numerous times. But again, I mean, for me, it's, you know, you're seeing the workings of the artist, you know, what's going on in his mind and how he's working out the composition. And or maybe the client he's working for wanted the staff to be in a different location. Or
That's right. It is true. He's problem solving.
Mm-hmm. So you see a lot of those kind of things will pop up. It's not, you know, common. And in the art museum, there's one conservator who it seems like every painting she works on has a surprise like that. So we're all jealous that it's not us.
So you've mentioned X-ray and then you said infrared technology. Are there any other types of tools or methods that you use to be able to see the painting the way you need to see it?
There is so much available now. We're like in an imaging renaissance, you know, so all of the imaging techniques that are available, you know, through medical centers, I mean, you can apply those to art. And one of the applications is with lasers and through this Art Plus Science initiative that I established at the Art Museum about 6 or 7 years ago. We've worked with universities in the area, and with Duke University, they have a really amazing, you know, laser setup, and they were very interested in using their lasers not to destroy the art, you know, like a laser beam, but you know, to use the laser for diagnostic purposes. And so they came up with this technique. It's called pump probe microscopy, and it's basically a virtual cross section. You know, paintings are layered like a cake. You know, so the artist applies, you know, a gesso and then an underpaint and then different layers of paint and glazes, and you may get, you know, six layers of paint, and you can only see the one that's on top. And so it helps to understand the construction of that layer cake. And the traditional way is to take a scalpel and pop a little chip off and then put it under a microscope, and you can examine. There are techniques that you can use to examine the different layers, and that will tell you, give you information. The virtual cross-section, the idea is that you don't have to take a chip. And it actually worked really good. And we were the first museum to use this technique. And one really good example is the two Lattos that we have. He's a Renaissance painter, Italian painter from the early 16th century. And yeah, one of the paintings is better than the other. And the mystery is, you know, well, why is this one so bad? Is it a copy of one that was missing? You know, we don't really know. But so using this laser technology, we were able to actually take many different virtual cross sections. And you could see that the one that was better had, you know, 4 or 5 layers of paint. And the one that looked, you know, not as good only had like 1 or 2 layers of paint. So, you know, this was very much, the one with 6 layers was very much the technique that Lotto uses, because he likes paint, he applies different layers and glazes. And so at least we could determine that, well, that's why, you know, this one is original, this one isn't. We still don't know where this one came from, the one without the one that wasn't as good. But, you know, we could pretty much establish with this non-invasive, non-destructive technique. And so that's what, you know, when you go to the hospital, there are all these techniques available and, you know, that are not going to cause damage. So they can diagnose a human, diagnose a painting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it used to be just, you know, ultraviolet light and infrared reflectography and x-rays. Now it's all these, you know, different techniques that involve, you know, really high-tech imaging, and they just continue to develop.
What a great tool. And as you said, it isn't invasive. You're not hurting, destroying the work, even though I know it was in small, small microscopic bits that you would take off to study, but that really is remarkable.
We have a whole collection of little bits of paint. You take the little chip of paint and you embed it in a polyester plastic, and then you sand it down and you can see the layers. But again, it's not, you're taking an actual part of the painting, you're taking it from a part that's already damaged, or you're minimizing the loss, but, you know, it's hard to control. You know, maybe a big chunk will break away, and I mean, it's just, it's, so anyhow, again, it's like, you know, do no harm like a doctor.
That's right, right. Well, I know even when we sent a few of our works to the Getty for a potential reunited triptych, that research, and I know they had to remove a paint sample from each of those works to be able to do that kind of study. And that was really before, much before your exploration with the universities to do. That's just really something.
I mean, there's some conservation scientists who, you know, still don't see any reason why you shouldn't continue to take paint chips. But there's still, you know, reasons for it. But I think, you know, we can get by now without taking, you know, any sample.
That's right. That's right.
Identify pigments, identify layering, you know.
I know, and it's been interesting because I think one of the last times we were visiting your lab there in North Carolina, you showed us some images of some of those Northern European works that are cradled on the back, because there's a nice lattice work on the back of those paintings to keep them stable at some point in the past. Well, that's probably not the healthiest for the painting, but even seeing those layers too of, so that you could understand how the cradle was constructed with the painting. That even knowing that is helpful to apply restoration and how to conserve and save that work.
Absolutely. And but actually that brings up another one of the Duke collaborations was when you take an x-ray of one of those panel paintings with a cradle on the back, the x-ray can be hard to read because you've got the lattice work of the cradle, you know, in the image. And so there are ways that conservators can, you know, input the high resolution image into Photoshop and manipulate it and, you know, minimize the cradle pattern. But we worked with a mathematician at Duke, and she came up with an algorithm, you know, talking virtual, I mean, an algorithm that would basically push the easy button, and the algorithm would work to actually remove, you know, the cradle pattern from the image so that you could read the image not confused by the cradle pattern. And that's been adopted by, you know, labs across the world now, because it's so much,
it's so useful.
It's so useful. You get better images, and it doesn't take as much time. And I can even do it. It doesn't require a highly skilled, you know, technician who knows how to use Photoshop.
Wow, it's excellent. Well, is there anything you'd encourage a non-art person to do in looking at art and artistic objects?
Oh, lots of advice. But I think what's important is that people actually spend the time in front of the work of art, whatever it is. I mean, most people, I think they go to an art museum. Maybe, you know, you want to see the Monet, you know, it's, you know, you have, you know, a list of things that you want to see and then you move on. And I think it's really important, whatever museum you go into, that, you know, you take your time, you stand in front of the actual artwork, you know. You can read the label, but it's important to actually take in the artwork and then, you know, sort of see what talks to you. And it may be that there's something intellectual that piques your curiosity, or, you know, maybe, you know, there's some kind of a emotional resonance you have with it. And then what I would encourage people is if they have a positive experience, then they jot down the name of the painting, the artist, and then, you know, go online and find out more about it. You know, maybe see some more paintings by that artist, or maybe, you know, there's something online that will, you know, pique your curiosity more. But I think you have to start with, you have to have a human relationship with the artwork, and you can only get that by standing in front of it, just like with a person.
That's right. Yeah, that's good advice. All right, well, is there anything you wanted to share that you didn't get to share?
I think I have rambled on
okay.
too much.
You did great. So you've learned a blend of general to specific processes and techniques that conservators follow to care for an art collection. There's scientists, historians, and artists working to preserve centuries-old objects for our present enjoyment and future generations. And with this understanding, we hope you'll appreciate all the more the incredible resource you have in the collection at the Museum and Gallery. If you would like to know more about the Museum and Gallery and its internationally respected collection of European Old Masters, visit bjumg.org.